So now we come into the Dark Ages from about the year 400 to 1000 AD. And I want to start tonight roughly with this event known as the Fall of Rome. That's really where I want to start tonight. It was in the year 410 AD that catastrophe came. The barbarians from the north began to press down on the city of Rome. And there came the Vandals, as we still call them today. They are people who destroy everything in their path. And the Vandals came, the Franks came, the Huns came, and the Goths came. And these barbarians, who were called barbarians because of their war cry, bar, 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 bar. In fact, these barbarians came, pressing now into the city of Rome. And they laid siege to it. And that day, Rome fell. And the Romans ended up, they left Britain that were there to go back to defend the city. But guess what? They weren't able to do it. Because as soon as the Romans got out of Britain, in came the Jutes, the Anglos, the Saxons. They charged into England. And they destroyed Christianity there, as well as in southeast Scotland as well. So the Christianity which was brought into Great Britain by the Roman soldiers, which was in England now for the first 400 years, vanished when the Romans left Britain. And as a result, the Anglo-Saxons came in and they conquered it all. Now it seemed as if when Rome fell, that this was the end of everything. In fact, Jerome, writing in Jerusalem, said, "The human race is included in the ruins." And the people's thinking was this: this is the end of everything. Rome is gone. There's nothing left. In fact, the people at that time thought it was the end of civilization. And it was really puzzling to the church during that time, because Rome was Christian. And yet here it was, where it had survived hundreds of years as a pagan empire. Now becomes a Christian empire when it collapses. And as a result, many Christians couldn't understand this. How is it that they could be pagan for hundreds of years, and now that it's Christian, it collapses? And there was this one man who thought it through, and he came out with this most incredible statement. And what he said was this. He said, "Listen, this is the best thing which has ever happened." And guess what his name was? You've all heard of him. His name was Saint Augustine. And it was Augustine who prayed this prayer. He would say, "Lord, give me chastity, but not just yet." And it was Augustine who said, "Love, but do what you like." Let me tell you a little bit about this character. And I've said it before in former teachings that I've done with you folks. Augustine alone has had more influence on the church and church history than any other man who has ever lived after the life of the Apostle Paul. Augustine was born in North Africa, and when he went as a student to the University of Carthage, he got into the wrong crowd there with his friends, and it wasn't long. Augustine had a concubine with which he had a son out of wedlock, and he lived in this unlawful union with this woman for some 20 years. Now, Augustine had a pagan father. However, he had a very saintly and godly mother, and this mother of Augustine would pray for her son every day with tears, and she would pray for this wayward son of hers. But later, because of Augustine's brilliant mind and his academic career, he was invited to become a professor of rhetoric in Milan University. And it was there where he went to hear this saintly bishop who was known as Ambrose. And it was under the preaching of that bishop that this young man, Augustine, with his brilliant mind and his shamelessly immoral lifestyle, through the preaching of Ambrose, he was brought under tremendous conviction and uncertainty of his destiny with God due to sin in his life. And one day he was sitting in a garden weeping over the mess he'd made of his life. And he heard a child's voice. It was a boy's voice over the garden wall saying, "Talelegi, talelegi," which means take up and read, take up and read. So Augustine never found out who that boy was. But as he was sitting there, he did notice a scroll that was next to him on the bench where he was sitting. And he picked it up. He unfurled it and he began to read. And it was a letter of Paul to the Romans. And Augustine read it through, and as a result, light had dawned upon him. And when he walked out of the garden onto the street afterwards, the woman who had lived with him for 20 years saw him, and she began to run toward him, and he began to run away from her. And as she was chasing him, she was saying, "Augustine, it is I, it is I." And as Augustine was running, he looked back, shouting over his shoulder, "But it is not I. It is not I." And as a result of what he had read and the Spirit of God shining a light upon this, he began to straighten out his life. And he began to write. And he has written down this entire story that I'm telling you about his conversion in a book. And that book is titled Confessions of Saint Augustine. And when Augustine was in his middle age, Rome fell during that time. And the whole world seemed to collapse around his ears. So Augustine began thinking about this. And as a result of thinking of what had taken place, he finally writes this second book called The City of God. And in this book, what Augustine says is this. He says, "It is a good thing that this pagan city of Rome's collapsed, because now the city of God can replace it. And it's a good thing that an earthly empire has come to an end, so that a heavenly empire now can be established." And it was this book that brought hope and new life to many people who thought it was the end of the world for them. And it brought them to see that there was a city of God, that it still survived when the city of men was gone. But I'm afraid to tell you guys, this is where the trouble actually began. Because the people began to say, "What is this city of God? Is it a visible thing? Is it an invisible thing? Is it an earthly thing? Is it a heavenly thing?" And I'm afraid at this point that Augustine had led many people now into this misunderstanding through the second book. And the funny thing is, centuries later in the Reformation, the Protestants said, "We follow Augustine." And then the Roman Catholics also said, "We follow Augustine." But the Protestants were following the first book called Confessions of St. Augustine. And the Catholics now were following the second book called City of God. And this is what happened. And the church said, "Well, if that's the truth, then the church is now the new empire." And one of the first results of this was the rise of the Roman bishop now to the position of emperor within that new empire. And in those days, there was this great debate about the word pope, which essentially means father. And in spite of the fact that Jesus himself said, "Don't call anyone on earth father, because you only have one Father in heaven." And in spite of that, even, they began to call the local priests Father. Then they began to call the regional bishops Father. And then finally, the five great bishops of Jerusalem, Alexandria, Constantinople, Rome, and Carthage began to say, "Look, if you're going to call any man father, it ought to be us five." And then again, finally now, the Bishop of Rome, now says, look, the city of Rome is gone, but I'm the emperor now. I am the chief bishop, and from now on, you're only going to call me Pope. You will only call me Father. And thus, as a result of this, the papacy as we know it came into being. And the interesting thing is this, the Pope adopted the titles and even the robes of the Roman Emperor. He even adopted the Roman title, and that title is Pontifex Maximus. Yeah, Pontifex Maximus, which otherwise is known today as the Pontiff, as we call it. And that was a Roman Emperor's title. So you can see now that Augustine's idea was mistaken, and the people thought that the church was now the new empire, and therefore it must have a new emperor. It must have robes and ceremonies and even a throne. And so the church now became an empire, and the Pope became its king. And of course, as you can imagine, there were many Christians out there saying, wait a minute, I am not having any of this. In fact, the French Christians wouldn't have it. The Irish Christians wouldn't have it. The Welsh Christians wouldn't have it. The Scottish Christians, they're not going to have it either. But I'm afraid to tell you tonight that the English Christians did. And at one time, it looked as if the British Isles would be caught between those who believed that Christianity didn't have a pope and those in Christianity who believe that Christianity did have a pope. You see, Ireland, through St. Columba, went into Iona and into Scotland, and he led Scotland to Christ. And then down came Aidan to the Isle of Lindis, where the ruins of Aidan's church, they're still there to this day. And what did they do? They established what they call Celtic Christianity, which is a non-papal Christianity. And Christianity came through Ireland and Scotland now into England in the north. But later, the Pope said, we've got to get to England. So what did he do? He sends out a missionary, another man named Augustine, who's another Augustine, and he landed on the Isle of Thanet. So we see here Aidan, who had landed on the Isle of Iona. Now we have Augustine, who landed on the Isle of Thanet. And these two sorts of Christianity, non-papal Christianity versus papal Christianity, would later meet at Whitby. And you can still see the ruins today. They're in Whitby Harbor where these two met. And it was there in the year 660 AD where Celtic non-papal Christianity met papal Christianity. Now, which one would win? Well, here's the tragedy again. It was papal Christianity that won out in those days. And it was then that the British Isles came under the papal throne. And Scotland ended up changing its patron saint from St. John now to St. Andrew. And the whole situation was changed. Now, the other churches, as you could imagine, wouldn't have any part of this. There were churches located in the eastern part of the Mediterranean. You have the churches of Greece, the churches of Asia Minor, of Syria, of Egypt. And they said, listen, we're not acknowledging this. It's not scriptural that there should be one Papa, one Father over the whole church. This is not the New Testament. And there began a split. And that split was finally completed in the year 1054 that kept the East and the West churches apart. And this division now of the Eastern and Western churches would last up until the 1960s, modern times. And it was only up until then that the Eastern Church and Western churches began to even speak with each other. But for 1,000 years, they had split over this very thing I'm explaining to you. And of course, they still needed to resolve this issue when they began to talk together. But the church had become an empire. And the man who spread this idea the most was Pope Gregory. And then you have Leo the Great. He claimed to be Peter's successor. One of the most incredible things happened. In the year 850, the Pope said that I have discovered certain documents which go back to the first century, which prove that Peter appointed the first Pope, and the first one appointed the second, and he appointed the third, and so on and so on. Now we know, as the Roman Church now knows, those documents were proven to be a forgery. In fact, those documents are known today as the forged decretals. And you can go online and look this up. And yet the papacy we see now is built on a forgery. Let's take this a little further. There was another forgery known as the Donation of Constantine. And this forgery made this claim that all of Italy belonged to the Pope, and that the Pope discovered this forged document and said, "There it is. All of Italy belongs to me." And this is the kind of foundation upon which the whole structure of the Roman Church was based. And even Rome knows this to this very day, but yet they still persist in claiming this ridiculous idea of apostolic succession. And this power of the Church of Rome was extended until the year 742. And in that year, a man was born who had a dream. And here's his dream. He had dreamt was that the Empire of Rome would be restored now and put back on the map, with himself being the emperor. And you may have heard his name. His name was Charlemagne. And that name incites a chill whenever you hear it. Charlemagne. He was a ruthless man. And what he said is, we're going to have a Roman Empire back again, but its head is not going to be the Pope. It will be the Emperor. And in fact, Charlemagne had saved the Pope's life two times. Once from the barbarians, and once from the crowds in Rome who were very angry with him. So the Pope said to Charlemagne, "You've saved my life twice. What would you have me to do for you?" And the Emperor Charlemagne, self-professed at that time, said, "Here's what you're going to do. Christmas Day, you need to crown me as emperor." Then in the year 800 AD, Christmas Day, on Christmas Day in the largest church in Rome, in the Christmas morning service, the Pope crowned King of the Franks, Charlemagne, now the king the Holy Roman Empire. And 1,000 years later, the Holy Roman Empire still existed. Now you see, we've come full circle. Think of this. The Empire of Rome collapses now in 410, right? The church takes over the empire. And then in 800, the emperor now comes back and takes the empire back from the church. And now it looks like the whole thing is back again to where it started. Now, Charlemagne did some good things in his reign, and he did some bad things as well. He stopped clergymen from having concubines and visiting taverns amongst his good works. But there were bad works. And I'll tell you what one of them was. He would forbid the clergy to marry. And it was to Charlemagne that we owe this idea of the celibate priesthood. And this man, he came back, he started a lot of schools, again, he did a lot of good, but the one idea that he had, and it's a bad one, okay, was this idea of a kingdom in which he and the Pope would be partners, with himself being the senior partner, and they would run the church as a business. And he coined this phrase, Christendom. And it means a kingdom that would be Christian now under the emperor. And the word Christendom is an idea that still persists even to the modern day as I share this with you. And there are still some who hope that one day there will be a Christendom. And that's a kingdom that will be Christ's kingdom. But during that time, the church had become powerful, again, become wealthy, and again, corrupt. And once again, the protests came. Now we had a church that has a pope as its head, right? And this church was a church that worshiped images and idols. It taught people that they could be saved by doing penance, pilgrimages, right? And was telling people all kinds of things that can't be found anywhere in the New Testament. And the protest came in. It came in the east and in the north. And it came in from the east from two things. The first protest came through Muhammad and what they called at that time Muhammadanism. And the greatest judgment that's ever been on the Christian church has been the rise of Islam. Let me tell you what happened. This guy Muhammad was born at around 571 AD, and he was born in a town called Mecca. And Mecca was like the center of idolatry and superstition amongst the race of the Arab people. And in the middle of Mecca was this huge square building, and it was covered with black curtains. And inside of it was this sacred stone, which was a meteorite, which had fallen from the sky. And there was so much idolatry and superstition there in Arabia. And this man, Muhammad, grew up with this idolatry and superstitions of the Arab people. And he was revolted and disgusted by all of it. He couldn't stand it amongst his fellow Arab community. So listen to this. He ventures out now, first turning to the Jews and then to the Christians. And he asks them, do you have the true religion? And here's the tragedy. Muhammad never, ever met a converted Christian. The tragedy is this. He never saw the Christianity of the New Testament kind. What did he see? He saw priests, vestments, idols, images, crucifixes, church being run as a business. And he said to himself after seeing all these things, he says, how is this any less idolatrous than the Arab religions from where I live? Now, if Muhammad had just met one true Christian at the end of the 6th century. But he didn't. So what does he do? He says, right, okay, well, here's what I'm going to do. I am going to start a new religion, a religion that's pure. And he turned away from this wretched and putrid Christianity. And at that time, that's all he could find. So Muhammad ends up marrying this wealthy widow. And he went out into the desert where he spent years. And while he was in the desert, he claimed that God had spoken to him through a voice that said, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. And so Muhammad began to preach this. And he wrote down these visions that he had received in the wilderness, out in the desert. And that book is known today as the Quran. And as a result, Muhammad was persecuted. And so he fled to Medina in the year 622. And that is the date from which all the Arabs take their calendar. So their year is not our year. But when he came back now to Mecca, where he was born, he came with an army. And he would now impose this new religion on Mecca. And from then on, everyone was forced to pray toward Mecca. And so he started this religion now, which was a religion by good works, by fasting, praying five times a day, fasting during Ramadan, making the pilgrimage to Mecca, giving alms to the poor. You do all these things, you're going to get to heaven. And as a result, this new religion now got imposed on others through the sword. So it was conversion by sword. And Muhammadanism swept Christianity out of the Mediterranean. He swept Christianity out of the North African coast, and there wasn't a church there for centuries. Mohammedanism swept Christianity out of the Holy Land itself and out of Jerusalem, the place where Jesus died. It later swept through Spain and through Asia Minor. It swept into France and got as far as the gates of Lyon. And then it swept into Eastern Europe and got as far as Vienna. And it looked as if Mohammedanism was going to crush Christianity now through this huge pincer movement that began, sweeping the earth. And this was the greatest judgment of God which was ever allowed in the Christian church. And guess what? It was deserved, I believe. And Christianity, as a result, vanished over most of the Mediterranean coast, but no further. Because God wasn't going to have Christianity wiped out upon the earth altogether. God said, listen, no further and no farther. And guess what he did? He stopped the Muslims in Lyon and in Vienna. And so as a result, what they did, they withdrew to their present boundaries today, and that namely is the North African coast and up to Turkey.